Asia enthusiasts, and welcome to this month's episode of Style Points. My name is John Crow. Today, we have special guest Dr. Kelly Fedorik, who is here visiting us in Cincinnati from Stanford to do a journal club with our residents and to give a grand rounds the next morning. Fortunately for us, she also agreed to be a guest on the show today. Before we get to her, I'll let my co-host, Dr. Nate Moore, introduce this month's RSI.
Thanks, John. Presenting our RSI today is Dr. Rachel Kidwell, anesthesia intern and weightlifting enthusiast. With her max bench press of 135 pounds, she has more than enough upper body strength to intubate anyone rapidly, which is a perfect match for her topic. Set the scene for us, Rachel.
It's your first call of CA 1 year. You're getting ready to order takeout, and the pager goes off. A 56-year-old man with unknown past medical history presents following a gunshot wound to the abdomen approximately 45 minutes ago. He is awake but somnolent and is urgently rushed to the OR for an emergency X-lab. You have just enough time to introduce yourself and administer oxygen before your attending is pushing propofol and succinylcholine and you're placing an ET tube. It all happened so fast. Congratulations, you just successfully performed your first RSI. On this episode of Style Points, the RSI is about the RSI, rapid sequence intubation. This is an anesthetic technique that results in nearly immediate sedation and relaxation on induction, followed by rapid intubation. I know what you're probably thinking, it's in the title, RSI. Of course, we're trying to provide anesthesia rapidly. But how is this different from any other case? Well, one of the primary reasons for performing an RSI is to avoid aspiration in high-risk patients. Pulmonary aspiration is a significant contributor to morbidity and mortality, so it's important to minimize this risk in a patient who may not have an empty stomach. Preoperatively, this might include giving medications to decrease gastric volume and acidity, such as H2 blockers like famotidine and sodium citrate, or using metoclopramide for its prokinetic effects. One may even consider performing a gastric ultrasound to evaluate for gastric contents, if time allows, of course. And in situations with particularly high aspiration risk, such as a small bowel obstruction, it may be appropriate to place an NG tube prior to induction. Once in the OR, it's important to pre-oxygenate as much as feasible and have suction easily accessible. An ET tube and blade should be prepared and ready, as well as backup airway devices in the case of an emergency. Although studies have shown a greater first attempt success rate with video laryngoscopy, literature on the use of direct versus indirect laryngoscopy during an RSI is limited. For induction, we want to administer our medications quickly while continuing to pre-oxygenate. Any of the usual medications can be used for an RSI, such as propofol, etomidate, or ketamine, given patient-specific risk factors and hemodynamic stability. Following induction medications, administration of a rapid-acting paralytic medication such as succinylcholine or a larger dose of a non-depolarizing neuromuscular blocker like rocuronium should be given. It's important to note that non-depolarizing NMBAs tend to have a slower onset time than succinylcholine, which has an onset time of approximately 30 to 60 seconds. Some providers may also opt to use a defasciculating dose of a non-depolarizing NMBA 2 to 3 minutes prior to administering succinylcholine to help reduce the fasciculations, rigidity, and increased intra-abdominal pressure that can occur. One of the key differences of an RSI in comparison to general induction and intubation is foregoing manual mask ventilation once the patient is paralyzed. This is done to prevent excess air from entering the stomach and decrease the amount of time the patient is unconscious with an unprotected airway. Instead, once complete paralysis is achieved, immediate insertion of the ET tube with cuff inflation is recommended prior to mechanical ventilation. Confirmation of tube placement by listening for bilateral lung sounds, absent sounds over the stomach, observing chest rise, and confirming the presence of expired CO2 is appropriate. The tube should be carefully secured, and oftentimes an NG or OG tube is placed for suction and removal of any gastric contents. Now you're probably wondering, when is this even necessary? Common indications for performing an RSI are patients with a full stomach or unknown last meal time. This includes emergency surgeries, trauma patients, or patients who have not appropriately fasted prior to surgery. Although the risk of aspiration is less in those who supposedly have an empty stomach, one study found that 28% of aspiration events occurred in fasted patients. So what are the other risk factors that contribute to risk of aspiration then? A history of morbid obesity, severely poorly uncontrolled GERD, ascites, esophageal strictures, hiatal hernia, delayed gastric emptying, and other gastrointestinal masses or lesions are all examples. Another common population is those who are pregnant after 16 weeks of gestation or even earlier when those GI risk factors are present. A common consideration for performing an RSI includes the use of cricoid pressure. Cricoid pressure, or the Selleck maneuver, was originally described in 1961 by Dr. Brian Selleck as a method to reduce aspiration during induction. This method is performed by placing the thumb and index finger around the cricoid cartilage and applying force to compress the esophagus between the trachea and cervical vertebrae, thus preventing regurgitation of gastric contents. Pressure is held until the ET tube is appropriately placed. Although this sounds like an effective way to help reduce pulmonary aspiration, the use of cricoid pressure is not without debate. Studies have shown that application of cricoid pressure can actually make mask ventilation, laryngoscopy, and LMA insertion more difficult, and if unable to directly compress the esophagus, may even cause relaxation of the lower esophageal sphincter, which could definitely increase the chances of aspiration. With all that being said, cricoid pressure continues to be widely used in the anesthesia world and specifically during an RSI, but the literature on its efficacy is variable. Due to the complexity of these types of cases, having a well-developed plan and backup plan with equipment, medication, and assistance is crucial prior to performing an RSI. While the standard approach and goal of an RSI is common practice, there are several components that are provider-dependent. So take this RSI on RSI and feel confident performing your next rapid sequence intubation.
Dr. Fedorik, raised in rural Canada, completed her medical training at the University of Saskatchewan, followed by an obstetrical anesthesiology fellowship at Stanford. After working at the University of Toronto, she joined Stanford as a clinical assistant professor in 2020 and became quality improvement lead for obstetric anesthesiology in 2021. Kelly, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Today, we have sort of an interesting topic ahead of us, but before we get started with that, can you tell us about how you got interested in obstetric anesthesia?
Sure. I remember it very distinctly. So, I just mentioned to you, I'm Canadian, so our training is a little bit different. So I was a second-year resident, rotating on OB anesthesia for the first time. Loved it, you know, loved obviously the technical aspect. It's so fun for a junior learner to get in all those epidural reps. But we had an emergent placenta precreta patient come in bleeding. And there's very few things that really shocked me, you know, in medicine, like that can happen. And that was one of them. It was just completely blew my mind that this perfectly healthy woman was, you know, nearly on death's door because she was pregnant, right? Because of this complication with her pregnancy. And it just fascinated the whole process. It was, you know, a very, very bloody surgery, several liters of blood loss, several units of blood transfused, took her to the ICU. And she, you know, she did well, baby did well. But it just really lit a spark for me in the fascination that I was building with physiology of pregnancy, you know, the risks that come to otherwise healthy people. And it just kind of grew from there. I realized that you know, our role in that surgery was so essential as anesthesiologists, and grew from there. I just really looked at OB differently overall. I looked at pregnancy different overall, and chose that as my career path.
That's awesome. For some of our students who might not know, can you describe really quickly what a placenta precreta is?
Sure. So, we have it's called a spectrum, a placenta accreta spectrum now. And in the last few years, they've changed the name. So usually, and this is, you know, part of the fascination and the beauty of pregnancy, placenta is an organ that grows during pregnancy. It obviously provides, you know, nutrition and essential gases and gas exchange to the fetus. And at the time of delivery, even though it's been adherent to, or stuck to the uterine wall for 9 months, most of the time just beautifully just peels off right when you know, right after the baby comes out. And these cases of accreta are when, for whatever reason, there's a series of risk factors that put people at risk, but the placenta is adhering to some portion of the uterus. In the most minor form, accreta vera, it's just to the endometrial lining. It's kind of stuck. In increta, it's invading into the myometrium, into the muscle layer, and then precreta is the worst, and that's where it's invaded through and through the uterus, and it's often invading other organs, most commonly the bladder, but it really can invade anything else in the abdominal wall, bowel, blood vessels, other organs.
Here at the University of Cincinnati, we have a
accrete a clinic that we will send patients to that's staffed by us as well as the OPs. And we try to make a plan for them ahead of time. It's such a scary, complicated case. I do some of them downstairs myself, but I can definitely see how that would make a difference for you and point you towards doing something like obstetric anesthesia as a career.
Yeah, and I've seen a couple learners now behind me that in fact, we just did fellowship interviews last week, and one of our own internal candidates, that was the same story for him. He said, you know, I was junior and somebody grabbed me and said, hey, here's a really interesting case, come and join. And it was just like, oh, wow, you know, so similar path for others, I think.
So let's back up just a little bit and learn a little bit more about you. So let's say that you could have dinner with anybody in the world. It could be somebody from the past or even from fiction. Who would you want to have dinner with and why?
So I would love to have dinner with the late Anthony Bourdain. Sadly, he passed a couple of years ago. And, you know, he has nothing to do with medicine, obviously. He was a chef, author, and then probably most familiar to everybody, host of several different TV shows that looked at the intersection of food and travel and culture. I love food, love eating, love restaurants, love cooking when I have time now. But he just really used food in such an interesting way to, you know, experience new cultures, meet new people in a very unpretentious way. And I have to say, during residency, you know, 10 years ago now, in the thick of things, I would watch his show and it was just such an escape. Like, you know, it was on whatever part of the world, talking to people who have nothing to do with what I was doing that day at work. And I really, really cherished that. And it served me really well at the time. So
where would you take him for dinner, or what would you make him for dinner?
Oh gosh, I don't think I would make him anything. I'm not.
Yeah, that's a little scary.
That you know, I'm Canadian. I'm from rural Saskatchewan, so it's a very, very, very tiny, small part of the earth, very scarcely populated. The town I grew up in was 1,000 people. I don't think he's been to anywhere like that. You know, very remote rural Canada. He did some East Coast Canadian experiences in the Maritimes, that kind of thing. So I think I'd bring him to where I'm from. There's a really large Indigenous presence, mm-hmm. and also European, Eastern European population as well. So kind of a cool mix of food that I think he'd find interesting.
That would be interesting. I definitely agree. So when I emailed you to get this all started off, you were coming to us to give one of our grand rounds, which we really appreciate you coming and doing. Thanks for visiting us. You said that of all the topics that we could discuss, the thing that you are interested in was talking about the maternal mortality crisis. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Yeah. So obviously I'm an OB anesthesiologist, so this is front of mind for me. I take care of a lot of healthy pregnant patients, but a lot of sick pregnant patients as well. And, you know, I think if you open up news app or something, you know, you're going to be hard pressed not to find some sort of headline to do with the maternal mortality and morbidity crisis in the U.S. You know, over the past couple of years. So we are at a point of crisis. So the U.S., despite being one of the wealthiest nations, if not the wealthiest nation in the world, has maternal mortality rates that are double what our, you know, neighboring countries in the sense of socioeconomics are. And has been on the rise for about the last 20 years. So there is a little bit of a debate. There's a little bit of controversy with the way we've been recording maternal deaths and pregnancy-related deaths. But overall, you know, we're definitely higher than a lot of our counterparts. And I think the most striking part of that is there's a huge disparity within who's dying. So we know that Black women and Indigenous women are dying 2 to 3-fold the rate of white women overall. And we've, you know, done a fair amount of studies investigating, you know, the granularity of who those people are. And when you level things like education, socioeconomic status, zip codes even, That holds true. So it seems to be some systemic, probably bias-related issues contributing to that disparity. I think we're at the point where we've very well defined the problem. And my other area of interest in OB anesthesia is quality improvement. So we know the current state, but we have yet to really leap forward into doing something about it. So I think it's worth talking about.
So what are some of the factors that contribute to maternal mortality in these pregnant women?
The cause of death overall in pregnancy and in the postpartum period, which over half of maternal deaths occur in, has evolved over the past 20 years or so as well. Worldwide, the big three killers of pregnant or postpartum women are still hemorrhage, infection, and hypertensive disease. And that used to be the case in the U.S. about 20 years or so ago. We've now evolved that leading cause of death in that population is secondary to cardiovascular disease. And that's probably a reflection of the risk that people are coming into pregnancy with. We know that typically pregnant women are older, coming with more comorbidities. But, you know, we've definitely seen that change. So I think the reversibility or the ability to prevent is probably a little less straightforward when people are coming with these complex comorbidities, whereas the things like hemorrhage, infection, hypertensive disease have thought to have been a little bit more preventable, or we can have enhanced readiness and ability to prepare for those. The other thing at play that I think, and this is something that I've seen over my time as a trainee in OB anesthesia and as a staff, is there really is a long-standing cultural acceptance of women's suffering during pregnancy and childbirth. And you know, you mentioned that you have kids and you have a wife who's been pregnant, and I'm sure that you've been surprised, you know, despite going through medical training, at what pregnancy entails and you know, the amount of discomfort that we can feel, and also the black box and the mystery into a lot of what goes on, right? And even people within medicine don't have a deep understanding of it. But we know that for generations, pain and complications have really been dismissed as kind of part of the process. And, you know, there's even like historical religious roots where, you know, the curse of Eve, you know, has come into play, that you know, this is just part of what we as women have to deal with. And I think the consequences of that attitude are real. We know that when a pregnant woman says something doesn't feel right, that any delay in taking her concerns seriously can be fatal. And we know that at least over half of maternal deaths involve some sort of delay in diagnosis or treatment, and often because symptoms were initially dismissed. So, you know, in addressing maternal mortality, looking at what we can prevent, how we can be ready for it, how we can act on critical illness quickly as part of it, but also changing our attitudes and truly listening to pregnant women is going to be a part of it as well.
Well, if I count up all the months that my wife was pregnant, I listened to my pregnant wife for approximately 27 months. It's not easy being pregnant and going through the delivery process. That's also very tricky. Fortunately, we had inductions and we were able to plan and get epidurals, which we had 3 working epidurals, which we were very grateful for. That made things a little bit easier, but it's certainly not 100%, right? Mm-hmm. But we feel very fortunate to have been in the category where things went well. So things don't always go well, though, like you were describing. Can we talk about some of the reasons why things don't go well in pregnancy and childbirth in terms of pain control?
Yeah, and I've you know, been privileged enough to work in a couple different settings as both a trainee and a staff, and I've definitely seen different approaches to pain control during labor. Some of the places definitely have more of a technician type role of the OB anesthesiologist, and I think most of us who've done OB call have at least at some point felt like, you know, our only role or our perceived role was just throw in epidurals and kind of get out of there, right? Whereas other places, and thankfully where I currently work at Stanford, we have such a great team, great communication with our nurses and our OBs that our role is definitely respected and honored quite a bit more. And we have a much more active role in our patients' labor course and you know, experience overall. So, and I mentioned before that my other area of interest is quality improvement. And something that we follow as a metric is failed blocks. So how many blocks do you have to replace to, you know, what percentage of the time are you replacing epidurals so that they're effective? And it's funny because we can look at that metric kind of twofold, right? Whereas SOAP and some of our governing societies give us kind of a ceiling, like, you know, no more than 5% or 10% or whatever it might be should be replaced. But the attitude where I work now is we're almost proud of our replacement rate. And this is where, you know, looking at different types of metrics and quality improvement are important. So the absolute replacement rate is an outcome metric. But I think what is probably more meaningful is the process metric of how often you're checking up on these to see if they're actually working, right? And if you're vigilant and you're following up every couple hours and you're talking, you know, and empowering your nurses to reach out to you to say, hey, this patient's in pain, or, you know, I don't think this epidural is as good as it could be, you might have a higher rate, which we actually do at Stanford. We have higher rate than what SOAP suggests, and we're kind of proud of it because, you know, it means that we're talking to our patients, we're listening to them, and we're acting on their pain.
I think that's a really good way to look at maternal pain. It kind of flips it on its head, being proud of your replacement rate. We're paying enough attention to these women that we're replacing them more often for their benefit. I think that's a great way to look at it.
Yeah, for sure. And it does require a little bit of socialization. Part of our consent process is telling our patients about our replacement rate and, you know, that it's can be a normal part of the process that we're going to be here. We're going to be checking up on you. We have some tools to troubleshoot, but at the end of the day, if you're not comfortable, what we often offer people is a replacement. And that, you know, normalizes it. I myself had to replace epidural, which I'm very glad I got. It was much more effective than the ineffective one I had. And I had great experience after that. But, you know, I think planting that seed early, you know, is important as well.
So it sounds like one of the really important things to do is fostering good communication between the anesthesia team and the nursing team and the obstetricians. Can you talk a little bit about how you do that?
For sure. And I have to give kudos to my mentors at Stanford, the people that came before me that, you know, are now retired, that established our division and truly, truly established this amazing culture of safety and communication. It's unparalleled to anything that I've seen. And it's often like a recruitment point for our fellows when we're talking about interviewing people. They say, why should I come? And I'm just like, oh, you're going to see like the best example of how to communicate, how to promote safety, how to work as a team. And, you know, I can't say how they started that. I'm not too sure. I know it was a lot of dedication and the work of the champions being there, you know, putting in a lot of face time. But now it just kind of runs like a well-oiled machine. We really promote multidisciplinary meetings. So we have two every day as a large group where we meet with our antepartum team to talk about patients who might be high risk on the ward. We talk about our laboring patients, our patients who are scheduled for ORs that day. When we have a high risk patient who perhaps we're planning a complex delivery for, we might have several multidisciplinary meetings in advance, and that's going to be involving specialists that we're consulting, so cardiologists, other surgeons, that sort of thing. And our team is right there, you know, often planning those and taking a leading role. Something else that I'm lucky to take part of is simulation. We do in situ multidisciplinary simulation, and it's required that every nurse that works on L&D cycles through every year. Our trainees at one point in their training will all do it as well. It's not essential they do it every year, but our nurses do it every year. And because it's in situ, it's on our floor. It's not all that high fidelity, I'll admit. But you know, the purpose isn't to drill people on their technical skills or their knowledge. It's really to highlight systems issues and allow us to practice communication. And it is so effective. Not only does it break down a lot of barriers and allow us to dispel a lot of misconceptions, it just really helps build the team. You know, it's a nerve-wracking experience for everybody that takes part in it, but you come together, you've got OB residents, OB anesthesiologists, and our nursing team, and it's really a fun thing to take part of. That's super effective.
I think that's a really good way to get everybody on the same page. You can debrief together what went well, what didn't go so well, so that when the bad things happen in real life, we're more on the same page.
For sure. And also breaks down that hierarchy as well. This is where we really empower people to speak up and use their voice and advocate for their patients.
Obviously, prevention is a really important piece of the puzzle when it comes to taking care of moms, taking care of babies as well. However, oftentimes when people come to the OB floor, we are meeting them for the first time and we didn't really have a chance to interact with them before, because usually as anesthesia providers, we're meeting them because they went into labor that day and we happen to be working that day. So we don't have that benefit of having a long-term connection where we can do any risk stratification or optimization, that sort of thing. So let's talk about what we do in the pre-op assessment. What can we do in the very short term to try to optimize people, to try to minimize morbidity and mortality for these women?
You're right. We're at a bit of a disadvantage in that we're typically only meeting people for the first time when they're at that kind of critical moment in their pregnancy journey. Obviously, the exception is if we've done some prenatal planning for high-risk patients. But most of the time, we don't get that. And there's a lot of people who come in with complex conditions that only have arisen at that, you know, later term moment in their pregnancy. Personally, my assessment of those patients who could be high risk, who I'm trying to triage to determine if they're high risk, obviously the basics, history, physical examination, chart review, but, point of care ultrasound is the reason that I'm visiting here. It's what I'm going to be talking about tomorrow in obstetrics. I think has absolutely revolutionized personally my practice and practice of it has the potential to really change, I think, outcomes for these women overall. You'll hear me tomorrow talk a lot about point of care ultrasound's role in hemorrhage, underlying cardiac disease. And tonight at Journal Club, I don't know if you're able to attend, but we're going to be talking about its role in severe preeclampsia. And I think that's one of the most impressive areas that we can make a difference. I have to say, I mentioned Procreta was this like light bulb moment for me when I was a trainee. But severe preeclampsia for me, since I've been in attending, has been one of the most humbling diseases that I've come across. I've seen some very sick patients and lost patients actually due to it. So how can we triage these patients, optimize them, give them precision medicine? And it really, I think, comes down to point of care ultrasound. Doing something as simple as a lung ultrasound, which in the scheme of point of care ultrasound is probably the easiest thing that you can possibly do. Very good evidence that a normal lung ultrasound, dry lungs, A lines, is reassuring that this patient has normal cardiac function and that they're not at least experienced that type of end organ dysfunction. Whereas detecting wet lungs is pretty closely correlated with diastolic dysfunction and knowing that you need to perhaps target fluid therapy very carefully in these patients. Maybe they need some invasive monitoring. And these are the type of patients that, you know, thinking about ICU, step down, that kind of thing, could possibly save their life. A lot of the bad outcomes they experience are in the postpartum period as well. So ensuring that they get appropriate follow-up after that. So giving, you know, having this tool now to truly, no pun intended, have a window into what's going on in their chest, in these essential organs along the heart, truly is changing the game. And I think the more of us that are skilled in that, that can bring that, will perhaps pivot at least a portion of this crisis that we're in.
Well, personally, I plan to be at your journal club and I am planning to be at Grand Rounds. So I am definitely looking forward to hearing you talk about it. I wonder if you could, for some of our listeners who won't get the chance to do that, talk a little bit more about point of care ultrasound and its role, because I think it's very interesting when it comes to obstetric anesthesia.
For sure. I could talk about that all day. So point of care ultrasound, or POCUS, for anybody who's not familiar, is using the ultrasound machine at the point of care. So the key here is that it's at the bedside. And it does need to be differentiated from like a comprehensive ultrasound that a sonographer, cardiologist, or radiologist would do, in that they serve different purposes. So we're doing point of care to answer largely binary questions: is yes, no, is there pathology there? And to help guide our direct management. So what is the next step? Is this going to change this patient's disposition? Is it going to change our medications that we're planning to use? Is meant to be something that we could do any time of the day, any time of the night. And this is where it fits so well into obstetrics. So as you know, obstetrics is a very nocturnal specialty. The babies come at any time that they want to. A lot of times they come more at night, I think, statistically. And access to formal examinations at that time, and specialists can be limited. So having an extra tool that will help you triage your patients, optimize them, determine, you know, the safest plan for them is going to be really, really helpful. I think obstetrics is one of the best places to start POCUS if you're just learning as well, for a couple of reasons. Our patients are often awake, cooperative, especially and comfortable if they've had an epidural. That's kind of the best population to target. You put in an epidural and circle back with ultrasound and ask if you could do a little bit of practicing. And even the anatomical changes of pregnancy make POCUS actually really amenable. So the heart moves more anterior, moves more leftward. And then our favorite position for pregnant women, left lateral decubitus, is actually the best position for doing cardiac echo anyway, which is one of the trickier skills to gain. So, you know, if somebody's looking to take a course and they need a logbook, I would suggest spending some time electively on OB and getting your reps in that way.
I have been doing point of care ultrasound and I went through the ASA's course, which I recommend to everybody. I think that it's fantastic. And I'm one of the local mentors. In fact, after the podcast, I'm supposed to help somebody train on point of care ultrasound. So you don't have to sell me on it for sure. But I think that it's fantastic. It's a great tool in our toolbox to have. I wonder, do you often use point of care ultrasound for placing epidurals as well, not just risk assessment?
Yeah, neuraxial ultrasound has definitely been a game changer too. Populations that I think it's most useful are morbidly obese population, people who don't have palpable landmarks. And then I have to say one of the most rewarding experiences are the severe scoliotic patients. And it's interesting, it's happening less and less now because we've used it pretty consistently in our practice for about 10 years. But I remember when I was a fellow, this is when we really started gaining some traction using it. There had been patients who had delivered a baby 3 or 4 years prior, failed and abandoned epidural placement attempts, perhaps requiring GA for their sections, that kind of thing, that then when we pivoted to using ultrasound had straightforward functional epidurals. So just super rewarding that we can use it for that.
It makes a big difference. It's something that I have certainly used in that patient population, although I admit for most patients, I just, I still palpate the spine.
Yeah, you still need that.
Still need to do that. Was that part of your residency training? It sounds like we trained at about the same time.
No, actually. And I have to say, I think I can speak to some of the challenges in learning a new skill when you're an attending.
That is for real.
Really hard. Yeah, it's just the psychology of it changes a little bit. You're coming in your days off and thinking, what am I doing? But I picked up most of these skills a little bit as a fellow, but mostly as a junior attending, which was challenging. And I have to say, truly, OB was kind of the reason that I was able to really hone my skills in POCUS. I did try it a little bit in the main OR, but I have to say PACU patients where we do a lot of scanning. I do a lot of bedside teaching of our residents now in the PACU. Limited mobility, you know, they've just had a hip surgery. You're not going to roll them around to optimize your view. Sometimes not consentable. Sometimes they're in a lot of pain. So truly, I mentor as well for the ASA course. We sometimes have faculty or other fellows that sign up, and I actually just bring them to L&D and, you know, either go around to comfortable laboring patients or antepartum units. Some of those patients actually have some interesting findings, and it's truly the best place, I think.
So I wonder if you have any cases that come to mind when you think about successfully using point of care ultrasound to help diagnose or treat or manage some of these patients. What kind of scenarios, of course, in a de-identified way, come to your mind?
So I've, you know, I mentioned preeclampsia, severe preeclampsia. Just last week, you know, perhaps is a little bit of a boring case, but I think it really speaks to its utility. We had a patient who, severe preeclampsia, required a C-section, and appropriately per the protocol was fluid restricted because of the risk of pulmonary edema. She was on magnesium. And was a bit of a complicated C-section, a little bit longer than usual. Didn't receive a bunch of fluid per our instruction, and was hypotensive in the PACU. You know, somebody who's not preeclamptic, the first reaction that we usually do is to bolus them with some fluid and check the urine output, that kind of thing. But there was some hesitation to do that in this patient, and grabbed POCUS, took a look. IVC was completely flat. Lungs were perfectly dry. So we knew that there was some room to bolus there. So we just, you know, slow and steady did small 250 ml aliquots increments and monitored her serially during her course in PACU and got her optimized that way, which, you know, very simple, but just like a really kind of rewarding way to use it. I didn't pick up skills in the FAST exam until I did the ASA POCUS course. And I have found that to be incredibly useful on OB. I'll talk about some cases tomorrow in rounds, but post-cesarean bleeding. It's interesting because if you think of the foundation of POCUS is at the bedside, we're using it in real time to make decisions. Our OB colleagues have used it for years, right? Like every OB floor, if they don't have a cardiac probe, at least has a curvilinear that the OBs are using for their obstetric purposes. And they're really good at assessing the pelvis for bleeding, right? They look at the uterus, they look at the cul-de-sac, they look for free fluid around the uterus. But the FAST exam just explores a couple more areas where we can see free fluid. And interestingly, we've had a couple of patients who our anesthesia team have diagnosed with that bleeding because of our FAST exam skills. We actually caught a uterine rupture insidiously. It wasn't one of those dramatic ones, but caught that on FAST. And then several times now have caught post-cesarean bleeding in the other views, the left upper quadrant or right upper quadrant, that have been negative in the pelvis. So even though our OBs, you know, have their skills where they're looking in that area, that's been negative. And perhaps in the past, that would have been sloughed off as unlikely to be bleeding. But because we've kind of expanded our views of the belly with that exam, we've caught some bleeding that way. So I think it's a really easy tool and useful tool.
That's fantastic to hear about. And again, I'm looking forward to hear you talk a little bit more about it in the near future. So let's zoom out a little bit and talk about OB floors in general and system level changes, that sort of thing. What do you think our specialty, obstetric anesthesia, can do to try to make the biggest difference in maternal mortality rates?
Yeah, I think us as anesthesiologists are trained to be and paid to be good pessimists sometimes.
Absolutely.
We have to anticipate the worst. And, you know, a lot of times our preparation is looking at a situation and seeing how many different ways it can go sour and preparing ourselves for that. And, you know, a lot of the time it doesn't, but then when it does, if we're prepared, we're often in a better spot. So having a role in our system preparedness, so protocols for addressing hemorrhage, infection, hypertensive disease, assessing, being a part of the floor readiness, like this is where hemorrhage carts and tackle boxes for hypertensive disease come into play, all of those kind of things. We should have a leading role in all of those sort of initiatives. The most effective tools that we have out there, I live in California now, so I'll quote what we use with the CMQCC, the California Maternal Quality Care Collaborative. I'm not too sure if you guys have equivalent statewide initiative here, but they have open access to their protocols and their readiness packages. We in California have actually been able to pivot our maternal mortality rate quite significantly because there's been a statewide push to implement readiness protocols and packages for the, you know, preventable causes of death, hemorrhage, infection, and hypertensive disease. And OB anesthesiologists have had a big part of that initiative since its inception, and we continue to. On the flip side, you know, when we're involved in preparing and ensuring readiness, I think reviewing near misses and misses, we should be a part of that as well. And that's what also comes with our care collaborative is confidential inquiries into maternal deaths and severe morbidity. On a local level, we have a series of diagnoses that automatically trigger a review, obviously any maternal or neonatal death or fetal death in labor is reviewed. And then there's a couple other parameters and we have a seat at that table. And then on a statewide level, we're actually represented there as well. And obviously, learning from those cases, looking at trends, looking at systems issues that we can then convert into protocols, packages for readiness is truly essential for making a difference.
So let's say that I'm an anesthesia resident that's interested in learning more about this and trying to figure out how I can help with this. What are some resources that you would recommend?
Doing an OB anesthesia fellowship. Soft plug there.
Which we also really offer at our institution.
Oh, great. Yeah, we do as well, and we're recruiting right now. So I, you know, definitely advocate for doing OB anesthesia fellowship. It's a place where not only do you learn a lot about your role as an anesthesiologist, but you learn so much about pregnancy and obstetrics, and it truly changes how you can kind of get a bird's eye view of what's going on your L&D floor, for your population overall. Other resources, SOAP, so the Society for Obstetric Anesthesiologists and Perinatologists is our national governing body. We have conference every year. Actually, it's coming up first weekend of May. Attending that conference, just seeing what we're doing, what the cutting edge research is. We have amazing, keynote speakers and very inspirational talks, workshops as well. Actually, we host a POCUS workshop every year that you can come and get some basic certification and experience, hands-on experience with. Their website as well. And then outside of SOAP, there are several other really cool agencies. So the UK has been really influential in their mechanism for monitoring maternal mortality, morbidity, and they're actually the ones that started these confidential inquiries that we've modeled our system after. So the OAA is the Obstetric Anesthetist Association. Similarly, really great resources on their website, and they do have conferences if you want to make it over there as well.
So summing up, I wonder if you have any, I know that this is sort of an impossible question, but do you have any single piece of advice that you would offer to anesthesiologists that work on OB to try to minimize, limit, prevent maternal morbidity and mortality?
Listen to your patients. You know, I mentioned at the beginning that we're kind of conditioned, I don't know, in medicine and society to downplay a lot of the symptoms, reduce things, normalize them in pregnancy. And a lot of the time, that sixth sense that either our patients have or that we have should be honored and listen to them. And then from that, use all the tools in your toolbox to help them. You know, tap into your fund of knowledge about pregnancy. You know, we are really unique in our role on the L&D floor. We're come with such great critical care experience, internal medicine knowledge, and then our technical skills as anesthesiologists. So use that to advocate for your patients.
Lastly, I wonder if you could talk to us about some of your style points, whether that's points of your personal preference or things that have brought you success in your career, in and out of the operating room. What do you have for us?
So it's funny. On a lot of my evaluations that I get from learners, I'm quoted as being chill. And nobody in my family would ever describe me as that. Nobody in my family is in medicine, so that might say something about our, you know, the culture that we live in. But it's been something that I've heard, and I've kind of reflected a little bit on it. And number one, I don't always feel that I'm chill, but somehow I'm exhibiting this vibe. I think it boils down to, you know, my confidence in myself. I know that I'm very well trained. I've had world-class training in residency and fellowship and you know, the CME that I've done since then. But I also have a lot of confidence in my colleagues, my trainees, and the people that I work with. Like, they all have world-class training as well. And I think when you have that level of confidence, not only in yourself, but the people around you, things just get easier and maybe a little bit more chill. It's, you know, we've talked about parenting. If you can keep your cool, you know, 90% of the time, not when you lose your cool, but maybe when you're a little less composed, people know things are serious, right? And I do not keep my cool 90% of the time as a parent, but maybe at work I do. And I think that that's effective, right? Like, if you're pretty relaxed most of the time and you can kind of zoom out and look at the situation that you're working in, you know, pretty objectively, that when things are serious and you really have to, you know, ask pointed questions or use very direct communication to save a patient's life, it is effective. And then the other thing is, I think, you know, for our generation of physicians, the definition of professionalism is evolving a little bit. You know, the old stiff, fairly patriarchal definition that we were told to be, I guess, is evolving with, you know, the changing demographics of medicine, which I think is great. And I'm not afraid to show my personality at work, you know, all within being appropriate. But, you know, sharing small details about myself to my patients, to my colleagues, to my learners, really, I think, helps make me look human and feel human to other people, which is also really effective when you're working in a team environment.
Thank you so much for joining us. What I want to do when I get home is I need to look at the evaluations that my children have filled out on me and see if
room for improvement.
Yeah, I'm sure they would probably say, especially my 1-year-old, she probably would prefer for me to be mom 100% of the time.
If you could only. Yes.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to this month's episode of Style Points. And if you're from Stanford, thanks for sending Dr. Fedoric our way. Since I recorded this outro after her journal club and grand rounds, I can confirm that she did a fantastic job. If you enjoyed this episode, I would really appreciate it if you leave a comment or a 5-star rating. Though I'm admittedly terrible at doing this myself for other things, I personally decided that I would break the habit and left a 5-star review for the person who cuts my hair because Christy does a great job. You can do it too. It really helps other people find the podcast if you leave a rating or a review. As always, you can contact me at stylepointspodcast@gmail.com. I can get you a free Style Points sticker for your water bottle. Take a deep breath, open your eyes, we're all done.